Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. I'm Kate Young, and this week on Earth Eats, we revisit a couple of stories on yeast fermentation from last fall. First, we talk with biochemist Matt Bachman about his research and his yeast collection. And then we visit with some cider makers to hear about what you can make with a little bit of yeast and a whole lot of apples. Then Chef Daniel Orr brings us a recipe for another refreshing beverage, Garden Fresh Basil Lemonade. Stay tuned for all that just ahead. Sour beer. Are you a fan? Did you even know sour beer was a thing? Either way, you'll learn more about it in this interview. Dr. Matt Bachman is a professor of biochemistry at Indiana University. He spoke with IU anthropologists and food scholars Lee Bush and Maddie Chera about his work with yeast. Maddie Chera gets us started.
Dr. Bachman, could you tell us a little bit about your research?
So I'm mostly a biochemist, I guess, if I had to put a title on myself.
Okay.
And my lab does a lot of research on DNA replication and repair, so the types of things that go wrong that end up giving people cancer or other bad diseases. But we use yeast as our model organism to ask and answer lots of questions in biology. And so it's sort of a natural extension of my lab and my hobby. And that's where the fermentation science came in.
Dr. Bachman does research with yeast in his lab. And he also has a business called Wild Pitch Yeast, which we'll hear more about.
I moved here to Indiana 2013, summer of 2013. And pretty soon after that, started to go yeast hunting for various reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got a collection of hundreds of mostly local, mostly all, you know, Indiana born and raised yeast strains in the freezer in the lab now. And they've got all sorts of interesting, what a scientist might call phenotypes or what a drinker might just call flavors. And we've got ones that make beer sour and ones that make beer smell like tropical drinks and taste like strawberries and everything in between. And the reason people haven't used these before is basically because of industrialization of beer. You know, back in the day, it was standardized like everything else that if you use these strains, you'll get a consistent product and you'll always be able to crank out that batch of beer and take it to market. But I think probably historically, the types of strains we're really rediscovering were probably pretty common in Europe and elsewhere in whether it was beer or mead or your favorite fermented beverage.
If you take yeast from one place and use it to brew a beer in another place, so say you have a yeast from Germany and you bring it to Bloomington, will the local yeasts take over, or will you be able to preserve the flavors that you brought from the other place?
So most brewers, and that's, you know, 99% of craft brewers and 100% of, you know, macros, they're all using. Well, no, I shouldn't say all, but basically all using European origin strains. So these are things that, you know, came from Germany, from, you know, where lagers were invented, or they're British ale strains or something like that. And they do single culture brewing. So all they're putting in the beer is this particular yeast. And if it's the Coors yeast, you know, it's locked in a vault somewhere and only the Coors people can get to it. And so, yeah, it's that same flavor characteristic or aromatic characteristic or whatever fermentation character they're looking for from that strain, batch after batch after batch. But there are breweries that do what's called open fermentation, and literally, you know, the tank is open to the air. And so they may inoculate it with their favorite strain, but then Mother Nature is going to sprinkle things in there too. And then really it's just a race to see who can use up all of those natural resources in the beer. Brewing strains are really, really good. They've been selected over hundreds and thousands of years of brewing to eat sugar really quick. And so I would tend to think they'd probably dominate cultures like that. But Mother Nature's come up with some pretty hardy creatures too, so you never know what's going to get in there and do some fun things.
Bachman's work involves collaborating with Indiana craft brewers collecting yeast strands for brewing. They call it a bioprospecting or yeast hunting. They're looking for wild yeast with desirable brewing characteristics. They brew test batches of beer and conduct sensory analysis of the final products. They also provide yeast consulting, banking, and lab services, and they've worked with several local breweries and distilleries.
So it seems like one of the ways that you do this is you engage with the public in order to get some of these yeast strains through citizen science and working with homebrewing communities.
Yeah.
What's the relationship between crowdsourced information and your institutionalized research and I guess also your business?
Yeah. Those are all good questions. So, I mean, a lot of science ends up being sort of out of the public eye, you know, whether it's because people just can't understand it because scientists feel the need to use jargon that nobody can swim through, even their colleagues who are just in a slightly different field. Or they publish in a journal that's not open access, and so, you know, unless you're at an institution with a subscription, you can't get to it. But the benefit of the fermentation science really isn't to scientists always. It's really to the people that are fermenting things, like home brewers and craft brewers. So I've really tried to make this as accessible to the people that might want it as I possibly can. So I'll archive copies of the papers on my lab website and put them on ResearchGate, and we started putting them on BioArchive. And so as long as you've got an internet connection, you can get to the data.
Wow, that's great.
We have funded some of this by crowdfunding it. You know, the NIH doesn't want to give me money to make beer, and so we've had to come up with other ways to fund some of the research. And you know, we had, I think it was 60 backers on one of our projects to look at the sour beer microbiome, which was really great. And everywhere from just my mom throwing in a couple of dollars to craft brewers to people that just think fermentation's neat. I have spun out some of this into a business, Wild Pitch Yeast, to try to sell some of these yeast strains we're finding to interested people. Ideally, once we get Wild Pitch Yeast really up and running and rolling, you know, you'd be able to buy a collection kit where you can, like I said, go to your backyard or your favorite place outside and find some things and send them in, and we'll tell you what yeasts are out there and be able to return them to you to make your own beer.
So you've mentioned before that you've had to train your nose and taste buds for describing the beers that you produce, partly because citizens will give different yeast strains to you, and then after you isolate and brew with them, you have to tell them what you've created.
Yeah.
What is the process of training your nose and your taste buds to be able to describe beer like?
Yeah, so there's lots of different ways to do this, and you know, UC Davis has a great sort of sensory program, right? This is all sensory analysis, and you basically train yourself on known samples. You know, for instance, if you want to do sensory analysis of beer, you know, beer has malted barley in it and hops, for instance. So you can train yourself on what common hop flavors or hop aromas are, so that if you're given a blind sample, then you can pick up on, you know, what that chemical is, whether it's in your nose or in your mouth, and say, oh, okay, that's a hop essence I'm getting at, or that's what malty is considered as a flavor. And so some of it's just really, you know, as a beer drinker, you're used to these flavors. Now let's put some terminology into it. The hard part is when you get something that doesn't taste like a normal beer, and then all of a sudden you're like, okay, wait a minute, that's super familiar. What is that? And that's where a sensory panel, a number of people getting involved, is really handy. So somebody's like, oh, that's strawberry. And then that clicks in your head. That's exactly right. But strawberry is so far from my normal understanding of beer that my brain was having trouble connecting the two.
But you also talked a bit about the sour beers. Could you tell us a little bit more about what sour beers are and what developments you've made?
Yeah, especially why they have to be kept separate.
Yeah. So sours are traditionally or generally maybe soured with bacteria. And the bacteria make lactic acid, and that's what gives it that tart, sour flavor. And if somebody's making an IPA or a brown ale or a quote-unquote normal beer, you don't want it to be sour. You don't want it to be tart. That's considered an off flavor.
In Bloomington, a local brewery called Upland recently built a separate building to produce their sour beers.
So for Upland, before they actually had a separate facility in the wood shop to make sour beer, when they were doing everything in the same place at the same time, they were probably sweating bullets, right? Because if you get one bacterium in a batch of Dragonfly IPA, that's enough to ruin the whole batch, and you don't want to dump that down the drain. And bacteria are smaller than yeast, and so they can get in the nooks and crannies of all the brewing equipment, and they're really hard to clean out. And so even with really good cleaning procedures, it just takes one cell to ruin the next batch. And so that's why people usually make them in separate facilities, or they just focus on sour beer or clean beer, and they won't mess with the other one because they don't want to deal with the headaches. Our sort of most recent claim to fame, I guess, is that we found yeast, pure culture yeast, that will also sour beer. And you can kill the yeast the same way you could kill any other brewing strain. So, you know, Upland might use a California ale yeast and a Belgian ale yeast and a German Hefeweizen strain to make three different beers, but they don't worry about cross-contamination because they know they've got cleaning procedures that kill those yeast. Mm-hmm. And these things you can kill the same way. So you can technically now make sour beer and clean beer in the same facility without having to worry or go nuclear when you're cleaning things.
And I know we have two fairly new cider makers in town. Is that something that yeast gets involved with as well?
Yeah. I mean, oftentimes these mead makers and cider makers and sizer makers and kombucha makers and whatever it might be, it's really the same strains that everybody uses if you're at a winery or a distillery or whatever. And so I was down at Friendly Beasts the other day, the new cidery, and introduced myself and left them my card and told them we work with local weird stuff, and they seemed excited about that. So, hopefully we'll be able to get involved with more people.
That was Indiana University biochemist Dr. Matt Bachman talking with Lee Bush and Maddie Chera of the IU Food Institute. After the break, we talk with the owners of that new cider company Matt was talking about, Friendly Beasts. Production support comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. NeedMoreRoasters.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at PersonalFinancialServices.net. If you live in Bloomington and you spend any time on the Beeline Trail, you might have noticed a new bar pop-up at 2nd Street last fall. During their open hours, Friendly Beasts Cider Company throws open their garage door for outdoor seating and a glimpse into their cozy bar space. I spoke with the owners of Friendly Beasts last fall, not long after they opened their business.
We've got five of them today. We've got our sweetest one called Sweet Snout. And that's kind of like a dessert cider, so it's very apple forward and sweet on the finish. And then we have our seasonal hit, Cinna Sloth. And so that's a cinnamon cider, slightly toasty and sweet. And then the Buzz Boomer is a hopped cider with honey, and it's made with an Australian yeast. And boomer is another word for a male kangaroo. So we got the buzz from the honey and the boom from the kangaroo part. And then the whale's bow tie is a semi-dry cider, very clean, crisp, tart. And Cortad is our newest cider, and it's special because it's aged on cocoa nibs and in oak staves, and then finished with a bit of vanilla.
What is a stave?
It's a wood chip, just a fancy word for it. So not barrel aged, but still has some oak contact.
I will try the Cortad.
Sure. Do you want a 12-ounce pour, or a 5-ounce pour, or a splash?
Five.
Sure.
I think the oak makes sense. Like, I can kind of, I don't have the best palate for this kind of thing, but I do think that I'm tasting something almost tanniny, which I like.
The wood adds a lot of tannin.
I came back to Friendly Beasts for an after-hours conversation with the owners Fatima Carson and Ben Romline as part of our series called Making the Leap. The series explores what inspires people and gives them the courage to leap into the unknown, into the unpredictable world of starting a new food business, or in this case, a beverage business. I also wanted to hear more about the process of making cider.
We're just really into apples, and apples are just such a cool fruit, all the different variations in the apples and all the different types of apples there are and the different tastes and flavors in them. So that really fascinated us. And for a while we thought that we wanted an orchard, and we were reading orcharding books and looking at like orchard property, but that seemed like a lot of work to maintain a whole orchard when we hadn't ever really done anything like that before. So we're like, well, maybe we can do something else with the apples. And then the cider thing came up, and we thought that seemed really cool because it used a lot of the same things we liked about the apples and the variations of apples and all the different factors that go into that sort of scratch that itch. So we started making the cider at home and had a lot of fun doing that.
We'd read about so many different kinds that you could make, but just when you go out to go shopping in town, most of the ciders are really sweet. And so we thought, why not try making our own one to drink? And so we went to Blooming Foods and bought a gallon of the apple juice that they sell there, and went to Butler and bought a packet of yeast and made a 1-gallon batch. And then we waited 3 months to drink that one, and it turned out really well. So then we went and bought a whole bunch more 1-gallon jugs, and then we'd wait, and it would be like a grand experiment to see how it turned out a few months later. We must have made maybe 7 gallons at first, and then that fall we probably made 50, and then the next year closer to 200. And then at that point we started thinking about opening it as a business. So then that was this fall. I think I'm pretty entrepreneurial minded. Like, my friends and family joke that I'm always coming up with different schemes and ideas of like businesses that we could run, and a lot of them have been more ridiculous, but people humor me with those pitches. And then once we got into this, both of our families live in Michigan, and there's so many more small cideries up there. And so then we were kind of like, huh, we might be able to do this in Bloomington.
Next, I wanted to know, what goes into making hard cider? What kind of equipment do you need? What's the process? We started in the back room where the cider is made. Romline walks us through a description of the cider press.
You can see up here, the chute is where you can just chuck whole apples down, and then it's got a thing that spins around and crushes them up and mashes them, and they come out through this little red pouch dealy into a tray down here. And then what you do is you set up pieces of cloth, basically cheesecloth, that catches all the mash that falls out, and then you fold those up into little pouches basically, and you stack them one on top of the other in between little plastic plates or trays. And then we stack them about 6 high and then just slide them right down the tray here, and that big arm with the plate on it is the pressing hydraulic press. And that lever right there with the little red rubberized thingy on the end of it, you just push that down, and then it presses all the juice out of the mash, and then it falls out of a little chute down at the end of the tray, and then we pump it right into the tanks. We ferment everything, and it takes about 2 weeks to, ferment it for the yeast to do the process and it to get alcoholic. And then we like to age it for as long as we can. A lot of cideries have a filter that they can use to clarify the product to make it so it's clear in the glass and not cloudy. Because right after you've fermented, it's still cloudy. So as it ages, all that stuff that makes it cloudy settles out onto the bottom. Then you can get rid of it, essentially, and get the clear product out.
So you're having to look ahead quite a bit to plan.
Yeah, but once it's fermented, it's sort of stable. So we can just take 50 gallons out of the big one and put that into all the keg.
Do just like we've done some general estimating, because you have to figure out, since apples are only available in the fall, like the orchard we work with, we had to estimate for him like how many apples we were going to want. And then we're getting some juice pressed and frozen for us, so we'll be able to keep producing fresh cider throughout the tail end of the winter and spring and summer before apples come online again.
Yeah, that's the real stressful part there, because you don't want to undershoot that and then run out of supply to make it later on in, you know, the early spring or whatever.
So we had to have kind of like a reserve before open this fall, so we had to make a fairly large amount. And so it would have time to clear. And now we're kind of in the ideal time since there's apples still available. We're going to get some more in a couple weeks and then kind of refill up part of the supply and have it rotating. So you'll have different tanks at different stages in the process, like one that's aged and clarified and ready to go, and then newer ones. And then there's like differences that we'll do within each of the kinds of containers we're using. So we'll do different apple blends, and those change the cider a lot, or use kind of a similar blend of apples but with different yeasts. So there's a lot of variables to play with, and I think that's part of why we like it and what makes it so much fun, is that you can just make up a new batch kind of whenever you want to try something and find out if you like it and if people like it.
So what are all the variables that will give you a different tasting cider?
There's so many. Like Fatima said, the apples, I mean, year to year, the same apple from the same tree is going to produce a different flavor depending on how much rain it got, how much sun it got. So, I mean, growing conditions are variable. The apples themselves are variable. The yeast that we use, the conditions that we pitch the yeast in, if it's hot when we pitch it, if it's cold when we pitch it. And then certainly after we've got fermented cider that's aged and clarified, then, you know, it's the whole plethora of ingredients of the world of spices and sweeteners and, you know, anything you can imagine gets to be a factor that could be a flavor in the cider.
Where do you get the yeast?
Butler Winery, their brew store, has a whole bunch of different varieties that we've tried out. We've been ordering online from different brewer supply stores. We've gotten really into this one from the Australian Wine Research Institute. It's supposed to be really good for making ciders with non-cider varietal apples. And that one seems to have worked really well for us.
And then just one of the days when we were open for business, Matt Bachman stopped in and he was telling us some about his yeast projects that he's working on. So we hope in the future to try out some of those and see what's already kind of on the apples and some of the yeast that he might be able to propagate with us. So it seems like there's a lot of potential, and the yeast part's very interesting. The apples, once you press them in the juice itself, it has just millions of particles of yeast already in there. So we've done a few where it's just a wild ferment and we just let the yeast do its thing, but those we're too nervous with, so we only do small 5-gallon batches for now. But so for the rest of the cider, we treat it with a low dose of sulfites before we pitch our own yeast in. But we're excited to experiment with like having the natural yeast in there and then adding a yeast and doing some more experiments that way. It's kind of high risk, high reward. If it turns out well, it's going to be delicious in our experience, but if it's gross, it's going to be not salvageable. So we try to keep those small scale batches for right now.
So you're talking about just a wild yeast ferment where you did not add any yeast. You just let the apples do their thing.
Mm-hmm. So we put two of those on tap so far since we've been open, and people seem to really like those ones. So I think every time we press apples, we'll do one or two 5-gallon batches just to see what the yeast variety that was on those apples makes.
That sounds really fun and interesting, and I get that it's a risk, but it also sounds like a risk that might be worth it.
Yeah, we really like that. It's a lot of fun to see how it turns out.
Yeah, it's nice to have a product that's so natural, like no sulfites, no sweetener, nothing added to it. So those ones are really satisfying when they turn out well.
Friendly Beast Cider Company updates their menu with the seasons. Currently on tap, they have a cider called Screech Owl Peach and one called Razzlesnake, featuring summer fruit flavors. Find links to their website at eartheats.org. Next, we have a recipe for a non-alcoholic refreshing summer beverage, lemonade. This one features a garden fresh ingredient that might surprise you.
Today we're going to do a beverage which I think will keep you cool all summer long. So we've got some basil. This basil is from Good Life Farms. So that's going to be our main flavoring. And to make that, I'm going to put equal parts of sugar, which is about a cup and a half of boiling water. Okay, and we want to blend that so it's clear. And to that, we're going to add our basil. We've got about a cup and a half of basil in there, and we're just going to pulse it. Okay, pulsing it, just lightly blending it, bruising the leaves, because we want to bring out the essential oils from the basil, but we don't want this to be a puree. We want it to be a clear, green lemonade. So now we're going to strain. This is a fine mesh strainer. Now, so we got that nice green mixture, and we're going to add the lemon juice to it. We're going to add about a cup and a half of lemon juice, fresh squeezed, of course. Taste that. Now, it should be pretty strong because we haven't iced it down yet. You can keep that in the fridge, and then just before you serve it, we're going to ice up our glasses. Pour that over the top. You see how nice and green, almost chartreuse colored that is. And that is our Chef D's Garden Basil Lemonade. Keep cool, everybody.
You can check out the vibrant color of this drink and even watch a video of Chef D walking through all the steps. Find it on eartheats.org. We hope you will check out our website and be sure to follow us on Twitter at eartheats. Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. Thank you to everyone who makes Earth Eats possible. Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, all the folks at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Matt Bachman, Maddie Chera, Lee Bush, Fatima Carson, and Ben Romline. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. For Earth Eats, I'm Kate Young. See you next time.